They'll find that out while they're interrogating him, Horst reassured her again. But for the moment, we can only consider our next move. Sven took a breath. We sent copies of the leaflet to every email address in the Reich, he said, and worked additional copies into some of the more complex computer programs in existence. They may wipe the first set from the network, but the second set will be resent every Sunday until a genuine computer expert removes them completely. It will take some time for them to even realize there's a problem.
A week, to be precise, Isla added.
More or less, Sven said. There have been some covert messages exchanged on the network, Gudrun, and promises to share the leaflets widely across the Reich. I heard the copies were found on trains and aircraft, Gunther said. Word is spreading, is it not?
Yes, it is, Gudrun said. How did the leaflets get so far?
I believe some people took them, read them, and dumped them, Horst said calmly. And the more people who read them, the better. We did ask Greedus to pass on the leaflets as quickly as possible, Sven agreed. He sounded surprisingly cheerful. They might just be taking us at our word.
That's good, Gudrun said. She held up a hand. What do we do now?
Nothing, Horst said. Gunther stared at him. You think we should do nothing?
Yes, Horst said unabashed. Right now the security services will be on the alert. I would be surprised if we don't get a few dozen new spies inserted into the university. Now they think they can pin everything on poor Professor Merkin. Anything we do may be noticed and lead back to us. We keep our heads down and wait for an opportunity to spread the word still further.
Gudrun frowned. But shouldn't we strike while the iron is hot?
We're more likely to be struck, Horst countered. Besides, what are we going to do?
We don't have any weapons, Leopold pointed out.
But we could get some, couldn't we?
We'd be smashed flat in an instant if we tried an armed uprising, Horst said curtly. I thought you would have learned that in the Hitler Youth.
So we keep pressing the issue, Gudrun said. I could go to Conrad's father and ask him about the leaflets, convincing him to go demand answers about the fate of his son.
It might be dangerous, Horst warned her.
He could report you to your father or the SS.
We've already crossed the line, Gudrun snapped. If we can't do anything spectacular, Horst, we can at least try to do something on a smaller scale.
I suppose, Horst said. But right now, they will be wary. We need to be wary, too.
He was right, Gudrun knew, but it galled her. She didn't want to admit it, yet she had a sense that time, her time, was running out. Maybe, just maybe, it would be better not to go visit Conrad's family, not to ask his father to demand answers. Because once they got an answer, Gudrun's father would start insisting she looked for another potential husband.
He could at least give me time to mourn, she thought bitterly.
We could talk to our mothers, Hilda offered shyly. My mother hosts bake sales and dozens of other activities. She's involved in everything. She might well start asking questions of her friends.
That's a possibility, Gudrun agreed.
Hilda's mother was the kind of person who pulled everyone into her orbit.
My mother might be interested if she were invited. So might Conrad's mother.
Horst nodded in agreement. The SS would have problems if they tried to round up mothers running bake sales, he said. There'd be a riot.
Gudrun nodded. But be careful, she warned. Not all of our families are going to be happy when we start asking questions, and suggesting that they ask questions.
Everyone knows about the leaflets now, Sven said. The risk may not be as great as you think.
I hope you're right, Horst said. But be careful. Be very careful. Because if we are caught, we will be killed.
Chapter 19 Reichssicherheitshauptamt, RHSA, Berlin, 30 July, 1985.
You're late.
Yes, mein Herr, Horst said.
The summons to the RHSA had come at an inconvenient time, and he'd been forced to come up with an excuse on the spur of the moment.
I offer no excuses.
I'm pleased to hear it,
Standartenfuhrer Erdmann Schwarzkopf said sarcastically.
There's nothing more important than serving the Reich.
Yes, mein Herr, Horst said. However, if I were to act suspiciously, the other students might regard me as a potential spy.
Schwarzkopf eyed him for a long moment, then nodded and turned to lead the way down the corridor. Horst followed him, feeling nervous. He hadn't been summoned to the RHSA since he'd first come to Berlin, a year before he'd entered the university for the first time. Any citizen of Germany would feel worried at the thought of entering the building, knowing that the doors could slam shut at any moment. But Horst knew he had reason to be afraid. If his superiors had figured out what he'd done, he'd die slowly and painfully.
They don't know anything, he reassured himself, as they entered the interrogation section and walked past a handful of unmarked doors. If they knew something, I would be in one of these rooms already.
We interrogated the professor quite extensively, Schwarzkopf said. He knew nothing, it seems. It was a dead end.
Horst kept his face impassive, even though Schwarzkopf was in front of him. Who knew who was watching through a hidden camera?
The professor was quite an important man, he said, flatly. Killing him would have unfortunate consequences.
The professor will not be returning to the university, Schwarzkopf said coldly. His future is none of your concern.
Yes, mein Herr, Horst said.
There was no point in pressing the issue. As a good son of the East, he was meant to disdain computers and other American toys.
Officially, he will have retired, Schwarzkopf added, cutting Horst off.
No one will know any differently.
They reached a small office and stepped inside. Schwarzkopf shut the door firmly, gestured to a chair, and sat down on the other side of an empty desk. It wouldn't be his real office, Horst knew. It was just a place to talk to the agents he handled, a place they'd never be able to describe if they ran into trouble. Personally, Horst thought Schwarzkopf was uncomfortably paranoid, but even paranoids had enemies. Besides, it was good tradecraft.
The students know, of course, Schwarzkopf said. It wasn't a question. How are they taking it?
Horst took a moment to compose his answer. He wouldn't be the only spy, of course. There would be others monitoring the university, and if his answers didn't match theirs, he would be in deep trouble. The only evidence that he was the only spy in Gudrun's group was the simple fact that none of them had been arrested yet, not after they'd started distributing leaflets. Horst rather doubted that anyone, even Schwarzkopf, would allow a tiny rebel group to get that far.
They are asking questions, mein Herr, he said finally. Many of them have family or friends who are currently serving in South Africa, and quite a few have dropped out of contact with their relatives. They thought nothing of it until they realized that other families had had the same experience. Then they started wondering what else they might have been told that was also a lie.
Questions, Schwarzkopf repeated. You have attempted to distract them, of course.
I have tried, Horst lied.
However, mein Herr, the public arrest of a popular professor has only given the leaflets credence. I do not believe there is any way to stop the spread of the rumors.
Schwarzkopf's face darkened.
That is not good.
No, mein Herr, Horst agreed.
However, the students need to focus on passing their exams. They may well lose interest if the matter is allowed to die.
Perhaps, Schwarzkopf said.
He didn't sound convinced, unsurprisingly.
Do you know who might have written the leaflets?
Mein Herr, there are too many students with relatives who are in South Africa, Horst said seriously. I have no proof that any of them are responsible for writing the leaflets, let alone passing them out in the streets. I will, of course, keep my ears open.
You'll do more than that, Schwarzkopf said. First, we expect you to find and infiltrate the rebel group. We believe a small cabal of students was behind the leaflets.
That, Horst had to admit, was frighteningly accurate. He'd assumed they would deduce as much, to be fair, but he couldn't help feeling a shiver running down his back. Gudrun might be in more danger than she knew. And yet, with a policeman for a father and an SS boyfriend, she didn't actually match the pattern of a rebellious student. Horst himself fitted the pattern better than she did.
And I am a rebel,
he thought with a flicker of wry amusement. The pattern fits. He cleared his mind as he looked up at his handler. Why a small group of students?
A large group would be easy to notice, Schwarzkopf pointed out dryly. We're looking, I suspect, for 3 or 4 students, close friends or family. Probably students with relatives in South Africa. We expect you to find that group and root it out.
I will do my best, mein Herr, Horst said. He'd have to seriously consider betraying a handful of uninvolved students, if only to give himself cover. By now, he was sure, there would be hundreds of other small groups in the university. If the group can be found, I will find it.
Good, Schwarzkopf said. Your second task, however, is harder. We intend to insert more agents into the university. You will be responsible for assisting them to blend into the student population.
Horst kept his face expressionless with an effort.
It isn't easy to blend in with the other students, he warned. I only fit in so well because I am a student. Anyone else would have problems fooling any of the other students.
Schwarzkopf's eyes narrowed.
Why?
You were trained as an SS officer, Horst said carefully. From the moment you entered Wewelsburg Castle as a new recruit, you were steeped in the history and traditions of the SS, everything from songs to precisely how to stand when inspected by a superior officer. You aren't posing as an SS officer. You are an SS officer. Every little detail confirms your identity as one of us. Could a civilian, even one with the correct uniform, mimic you so precisely that they'd fool a genuine SS officer?
Of course not, Schwarzkopf said flatly. They wouldn't be quite right.
Nor would your agents, Horst said. The university isn't a parade ground, mein Herr, or an army barracks. Your agents would stand out like a nude woman in the middle of the Victory Day parade. The only way to pass as a student is to be a student.
You could prepare them, Schwarzkopf said.
Not in less than 6 months, Horst said. They'd need to unlearn a great deal, mein Herr.
But we have orders to insert more agents, Schwarzkopf said. You'll just have to try your best.
Associating with them may blow my cover, Horst warned. Unless he was underestimating the SS agents, Gudrun and the other students would have no difficulty identifying the spies and isolating them. Newcomers in the middle of term would raise more than enough eyebrows. I'd have to be put in a position where I would be forced to work with them.
That can be arranged, Schwarzkopf said.
Now, here's what we want you to look out for.
He knew nothing, the interrogator said.
Reichsfuhrer SS Karl Holliston peered through the one-way mirror. Herr Dr. Professor Klaus Merkin sat in a metal chair, his naked body strapped to the metal and his face battered into a bloody pulp. The interrogators had been quite precise, as always, combining physical torture with a brutal beating that rarely failed to drag answers out of uncooperative suspects. But it seemed as though it was nothing more than a waste of effort. Either Merkin had the ability to fool a pair of experienced interrogators, or he was innocent all along. Karl turned to look at the interrogator.
You're sure?
He was practically pissing in his pants as soon as we strapped him into the chair, Herr Reichsfuhrer, the interrogator said. It took us some time to actually focus on the leaflets, because he wanted to confess to fucking 2 of his female students. But he knows nothing about the leaflets.
I see, Karl said.
He gritted his teeth. It was possible that the professor was concealing something. He might have given up one piece of information to keep the rest hidden, but he had faith in his interrogators. Besides, he rather doubted a pampered university professor, a man who hadn't experienced real pain since the Hitler Youth, could have endured a torture session without breaking. The man really was disgustingly unfit. Karl took a look at his chest and shuddered at the thought of him huffing and puffing over a nubile young German maiden. No doubt he was on the verge of a heart attack every time he took off his trousers. Torture worked, he'd been told, if the interrogators were careful to convince their subject that they would always be able to detect a lie. A proper session could take hours,
with the interrogators confronting their subject, their victim, with what they knew about him, just so he would lose the habit of lying before they reached the questions they couldn't verify. But it could be maddeningly imperfect if the victim retained his presence of mind. The fact that the professor had confessed to seducing not one, but two students, was a good sign he hadn't managed to keep himself under control, yet Carl knew he'd always have doubts. What if the bastard had managed to fool the interrogators?
"Take him to the cells, and have the medic see to him," Carl ordered finally.
He could have killed a rebel out of hand, or handed him over to the Reichstag for a show trial, but there was no point in killing someone who'd been scooped up by accident.
"And make sure he knows he won't be returning to the university."
He strode out of the torture chamber before the interrogator could reply, and headed up to his office, barely noticing the uniformed officers who saluted as he walked past. It was frustrating. The only lead they'd had was the fingerprint, and that had turned into a damp squib. Whatever the professor was guilty of, and Carl was sure that everyone was guilty of something, it wasn't being involved with the rebels. And that meant...
what?
The professor's fingerprints being on the leaflet suggested the rebels studied under him, but there were over 2,000 students at the university. Tracking down the true rebels would take a long time. But Carl was no longer sure they had time. He stepped into his office and closed the door behind him, then sat down and forced himself to think. There had to be a way of locating the rebels quickly, before word spread further, if, of course, it hadn't already spread right across the Reich. The computer network was a security nightmare because it allowed instant communications right across the whole continent. The Americans had offered to link their network into the Reich's network, a thought that had made the SS have a collective fit, and word could spread to every email address in the country. And who knew where it would go after that? His intercom buzzed.
"Herr Reichsführer, the territory's minister requests an interview at your earliest convenience," Maria said. "What would you like me to tell him?"
Carl frowned.
"Tell him I'll see him in 20 minutes, he said.
He had no idea what the territory's minister would want with him, but it would distract him from his thoughts about the future.
"And have a pot of coffee sent in when he arrives."
"Yes, Herr Reichsführer," Maria said.
And so another lead is gone, Carl thought, as he skimmed through the reports from the earlier interrogations. The Gastarbeiters had known nothing, of course, and they were now on their way to the great slave labor camps in the East. Their masters had taken the commission without checking it carefully, let alone reading the leaflets, and had very little to offer to mitigate their crimes. They'd probably wind up in the camps themselves once the Reich Council met to confirm their fate. "And so we are left blind." He was still mulling it over when Marie showed Philip Kunert, the territory's minister, into his office. Kunert was an odd duck, caught permanently between the finance minister, the foreign minister, and the SS. Carl respected Kunert, even though he didn't particularly like the man. It was his job to keep Germany's satellites in line, obedient to the will of the Reich, without provoking them into futile rebellion.
"We should just take over," Carl thought as he rose to his feet.
The Ministry of Territory was no match for the SS, but its master was not to be despised.
"Just make the French do as we tell them."
"Herr Reichsführer," Kunert said
as Marie poured coffee for them both,
"thank you for seeing me at such short notice."
"It was my pleasure," Carl said.
Marie retreated through the door, which she closed firmly behind her.
"What can I do for you?"
"The leaflets have spread to France and Norway," Kunert said flatly. "I don't expect trouble from the Norwegians, but the French may become a problem."
Carl swore under his breath.
"The computer network?"
"Someone printed them off at the far end, then started to pass them around in a dozen cities," Kunert said. "Vichy caught a couple of distributors, but they escaped before they could be taken for interrogation."
"They escaped?" Carl asked.
losing prisoners was rare. It almost always spoke of gross incompetence, or a deliberate decision to allow the prisoners to flee.
How?
The French aren't saying, Kunert said. But from what I picked up from my sources, they were simply allowed to escape by the security forces. Deliberately.
He leaned forward before Carl could say a word.
That's not the only problem, he added, grimly. There's a rumor going around France that we are planning to send French troops to South Africa.
Carl let out a harsh bark of laughter.
Do they really expect us to send cowards to fight in a war?
The French lost, and lost badly in 1940, Kunert said calmly. But they were betrayed by their leaders, not their fighting men, and now there are many Frenchmen wondering if the chance of freedom is worth the risk of death.
Every time we have fought the French, Carl countered, we have beaten them. We would have crushed France in 1914 if the British hadn't intervened and the Jews hadn't stabbed us in the back. They are not fool enough to lift a hand against us now.
I'm not worried about them fighting us, Kunert said. Vichy knows what will happen if they challenge us, and, yes, they will do whatever it takes to root out their own rebels so we won't do it for them. I'm more worried about the economic effects such rumors will have on our industry.
You sound like Kruger, Carl said.
The French supply us with various raw materials, foodstuffs, and a considerable amount of manpower, Kunert said, ignoring the jibe. Their production level has been poor ever since the 60s, when they realized they weren't going to get out from under our thumb. Why should they produce anything when 9/10 of what they produce goes straight to the Reich? They are still on pretty low rations, and they resent it. Far too many of the best Frenchmen are immigrating to North Africa, or fleeing to Britain.
Carl frowned.
So?
Their government is, if anything, more repressive than ours, Kunert continued.
The workers in France haven't been allowed a proper trade union for years, ever since we defeated them in 1940, and the worker associations they do have are more concerned with pleasing the government than assisting the workers.
There have long been rumors of plans to set up secret unions and demand change.
Which we will crush, Carl interrupted.
They may no longer care, Kunert said. The Spanish and Italians have the same problem, Herr Reichsführer. Their populations have long resented slaving for us. Now, they're starting to wonder what would happen if they simply refused to work.
Carl scowled.
And what will happen?
We'll start having supply problems of our own, Kunert said. He nodded towards the map hanging on the wall. These issues aren't going to fade away in a hurry, Herr Reichsführer.
I see, Carl said.
He gritted his teeth in frustration. The only French department he'd thought the Reich could rely on was the Vichy government itself. Massively unpopular, caught between the Reich and its own people, it was hellishly effective at sniffing out trouble. But if the French security forces were starting to rot, if the French military thought it would be sent to fight in South Africa, Vichy might lose control. And who knew what would happen then?
We have contingency plans, he reminded himself. We could get the panzers rolling into France within hours of trouble breaking out in Vichy. Except those forces are earmarked for South Africa. His blood ran cold.
And if the Americans start to meddle in France itself... Thank you for letting me know, he said.
Something would have to be done. But what?
I will consider your concerns.
Thank you, Herr Reichsführer, Kunert said. I appreciate it.
Chapter 20. Schulze Residence. 31 July, 1985.
Gudrun, Liana said as she opened the door. How are you?
Well enough, Gudrun said. It was hard to disguise her nervousness, but she had to try.
Are your parents in? Father's in the living room talking to Mother, Liana said.
She gave Gudrun a wink.
I think they're discussing my marriage.
Gudrun blinked in surprise. Liana was 16, barely old enough to marry. Hell, Conrad had been 20, and he hadn't been married before he'd gone to the war. But Conrad's father was a traditionalist, far more of a traditionalist than Gudrun's own father. He'd want his daughter married off as soon as possible, after he presented her with a list of possible candidates. She winced in bitter sympathy. Liana could only hope that the list included someone she might like and grow to love in time.
"They might have something else to discuss," she said. "Can you tell them I'm here?"
"They're always pleased to see you," Liana said, catching Gudrun's arm and hauling her into the small house. "Come on."
Gudrun nodded and followed Liana into the living room. Conrad's father was sitting in an armchair, holding court, while Conrad's mother was seated on a sofa, her arms crossed under her breasts. She didn't look very happy, Gudrun noted. She had a feeling that Conrad's mother might never contradict her husband in public, but it would be a very different story in private. God knew the BDM had told her, time and time again, that she should never argue with her husband publicly. Male pride didn't like it.
"Gudrun," Gerda Schulze said, rising to her feet. "How lovely to see you again."
"Thank you," Gudrun said, flushing in embarrassment as the older woman gave her a tight hug and a kiss on the cheek. She'd always liked Conrad's mother, but Gerda was a little too tactile for her tastes.
"Can we talk privately?"
"Of course we can," Volker Schulze said gruffly. "Liana, go to your room."
Liana gave Gudrun a betrayed look, then turned a pleading gaze on her father.
"Father, I..."
"Go," her father ordered. "I'll speak to you later."
Gudrun winced inwardly as Liana turned and stalked out of the room, holding her back ramrod straight. She hoped the girl didn't try to argue with her father later, but she knew Conrad's sister had always been impetuous. Volker Schulze sighed out loud as Liana's footsteps echoed through the house as she stamped up the stairs, then waved Gudrun to a seat facing him. Clearly, he didn't think Gudrun had come to see Gerda alone.
"He always was perceptive," Gudrun reminded herself.
"And if his loyalties haven't changed, I may be putting my head in the noose." She braced herself and looked up, meeting Volker Schulze's eyes.
"On Sunday, someone handed out thousands of leaflets in Victory Square," she said.
She had no idea if Volker Schulze had received a copy of his own through the letterbox.
"Have you seen them?"
Volker Schulze's eyes narrowed.
"I have seen the leaflets," he said neutrally.
Gudrun swallowed. Volker Schulze was a former SS officer after all. If he decided his loyalties still lay with the SS...
"The leaflets claim that wounded or dead soldiers have been concealed by the government," she said.
She tried to put a pleading tone into her voice.
"Is there any way you can check up on Conrad? Ask what happened to him? You must have contacts."
"Most of the people I know have retired or moved on to other posts," Volker Schulze said, carefully.
His face was completely expressionless, denying her any chance to glimpse his emotions. But his wife looked worried.
"It wouldn't be easy to get any information on Conrad's current location."
Gerda leaned forward.
"But you are going to try," she said sharply.
Gudrun had never heard her speak in such a tone before, even when she'd been asking questions about Gudrun's family and future prospects.
"Just for our peace of mind, if nothing else."
Volker Schulze gave his wife a sharp look.
"There's no proof that Conrad is wounded or dead," he said. "And I..."
"We should have been told if he was dead or wounded," Gerda insisted. "My father was visited by two officials when my brother was killed in the Middle East. If Conrad has been wounded or killed, we should have been told."
"But we haven't been told anything," Volker Schulze said, irritated.
He couldn't be pleased with Gerda arguing with him, not in front of a visitor.
"Conrad is fine."
"Conrad used to write to us every third day," Gerda said. "Even if it was just a short note saying he was fine, he'd write to us. We haven't heard anything from him for months."
"Nor have I,"
Gudrun said quietly. Conrad would hardly have stopped writing to his girlfriend, Gerda snapped. He wouldn't have wanted to lose her through neglect.
Asking questions could also get us in trouble, Volker Schulze reminded his wife. Do you really want to risk our family?
Conrad is our family, Gerda snapped. And Gudrun is going to marry him. She's practically part of the family already.
Gudrun winced inwardly. Volker Schulze wasn't looking happy at all. She understood his refusal to ask questions. He had a wife and daughter at risk. But she needed him to ask questions. And he wouldn't be very pleased with his wife afterwards. Gudrun hoped, prayed, that they wouldn't have a colossal fight after she left. She wasn't sure she could bear the guilt of splitting up Conrad's family, as well as concealing the truth from them.
I just want to know what's happened to him, she said, lowering her eyes and trying to sound plaintive. I miss him.
We do understand, my dear, Gerda said. We miss him, too.
Conrad knew he would be parted from his friends and family for months, if not years, Volker Schulze reminded her sternly. We knew there would be a long separation when he graduated.
But we also knew he'd be writing to us, Gerda reminded him. He was raised to stay in touch, was he not? So where are his letters? The censors might have covered the pieces of paper in black ink, Volker, but they wouldn't destroy them altogether.
Volker Schulze rose to his feet.
I shall contact an old comrade, he said stiffly.
He gave Gudrun a sharp look that made her cringe.
And if Conrad is fine, young lady, your conduct will be reported to your parents.
Her worries are understandable, Gerda said. Volker.
There are limits, her husband snapped. And I think she's crossed them.
He stalked out of the room before his wife could reply. Gudrun watched him go, feeling a yawning despair opening within her heart. Her father would be angry if Volker Schulze carried out his threat, but her mother would be furious. Gudrun knew she'd probably spend the rest of the week in the kitchen, barred from leaving the house, if her mother found out what she'd said to Conrad's parents. And yet, she knew she'd had no choice. The only way to ensure that Conrad's parents knew what had happened to him was to make his father use his contacts to check up on his son.
Don't worry, Gerda said, reaching out to squeeze Gudrun's hand. Volker may try to put a brave face on it, but he's worried, too. You got one of the leaflets, Gudrun said.
She hadn't had one sent specifically to Conrad's house, but whoever had been distributing them had clearly stuffed one through their letterbox.
I worry about him.
That's the curse of being a grown woman, my dear, Gerda said.
She patted Gudrun's hand gently.
We bring the men into the world, we marry them, we bear their children, and then we have to stay at home when they march off to war, knowing that they may never come home, or, when they do come home, that a demon might come back with them.
Like Grandpa Frank, Gudrun thought. He was so horrified by what he'd done that he tried to drown himself in drink. She shuddered. Grandpa Frank wasn't the only one who'd gone off to war and come back a changed man. She'd heard horror stories, filtered through the grapevine at school and then at university, about men who woke up screaming, fathers who beat their children bloody, husbands who bragged to their wives about how they'd slept with whores while at the front. She'd wondered at the time why anyone would want to get married to a soldier. And yet, her father was strict, but he wasn't a drunken monster, and nor was Volker Schulze. Mother must have had a hard time of it, she thought. She wasn't quite sure how the dates added up, but she suspected that Grandpa Frank had come back from the wars shortly before he'd married, long before his daughter had married Gudrun's father. How did Grandpa Frank treat his wife and daughter? Gerda cleared her throat. Gudrun realized, suddenly, that Conrad's mother had been speaking, and she hadn't heard a single word.
I'm sorry, she said softly. I was miles away.
I understand, Gerda said. I was wondering if your brother is still unmarried.
None of my brothers are married, Gudrun said.
Gerda couldn't be planning to marry her daughter to Kurt, could she?
Johann would be a better fit, if only because they were the same age.
I don't think Kurt plans to marry in a hurry.
Handsome young man like him? Gerda asked. Doesn't he have a girlfriend?
If he does, I don't know about it, Gudrun said.
She didn't really want to think about Kurt having a girlfriend, let alone a wife.
Why do you want to know?
Liana needs a man, Gerda said, and your brother is already an established soldier.
Gudrun shook her head sadly.
I don't know what he'd want, she said.
The thought of her brother marrying Conrad's sister was icky, even though it wouldn't be technically illegal or immoral. But she knew now she wasn't going to marry Conrad. He'd be lucky if they didn't turn the life support off in a few weeks if he showed no signs of recovery.
You'd have to talk to my parents.
She felt a sudden flicker of envy. Kurt could refuse if pressed. He didn't have an obligation to listen to his parents when it came to choosing a wife. He had a career. He had a life. He could marry a whore from the brothels if he wanted to, and no one could say no. But Gudrun herself? She had to listen to her parents when it came to getting married.
I will, Gerda said briskly. And?
She looked up as her husband returned, his face very pale. Gudrun took one look and knew what he'd been told. Volker Schulze looked like a man who had been punched in the belly repeatedly. Conrad is in hospital, he said numbly. He's not expected to survive.
Gerda gasped. How? Why?
There was an ambush, apparently, Volker Schulze said. He sounded shaken. Gudrun watched with growing concern as he walked over to the cabinet, produced a bottle of expensive imported whiskey from Scotland, and poured himself a glass. Conrad was badly wounded. They did what they could to keep him alive, but there was apparently some brain damage. He's not expected to survive. He swallowed the whiskey in one gulp and poured himself another glass. Gerda, I...
My son, Gerda said. Where is he?
I couldn't find out, Volker Schulze said. He downed the second glass of whiskey and refilled it once again. My contact couldn't open the entire file. It seems that certain parts of Conrad's dossier have been sealed. They don't want anyone to know where he is.
He may already be dead,
Gudrun said, shaken. How long had it been since she'd seen his torn and broken body?
They'd
have listed him as dead and closed the file, Volker Schulze said sharply. He stared down at his glass but didn't drink. Conrad, they should have told us.
Then the leaflets are correct, Gudrun said. Conrad isn't the only soldier to be wounded or killed in South Africa.
They told us it would be a walkover, Volker Schulze said. He glared at the radio as if it had personally offended him. That only a handful of soldiers would be killed in the fighting.
And if they lied about Conrad, Gerda added, how many others have also been killed or wounded?
Gudrun looked at her.
So what do we do about it?
You do nothing, young lady, Volker Schulze snapped. He swallowed the whiskey, then returned the bottle to the cabinet. You cannot obviously marry my son. I wouldn't expect you to honor your commitment such as it was under these circumstances. I shall speak to your father and inform him that the arrangement has to be cancelled.
He isn't dead,
Gudrun protested. She'd come to the same conclusion herself, but somehow, having it put so bluntly, hurt.
I could still...
He's a cripple with brain damage, Volker Schulze snapped. The raw anger in his tone shocked her to the bone. She'd never seen Conrad's father drink before, let alone lose his temper. He is certainly no longer capable of fathering children. You would be condemning yourself to life as a permanent nursemaid, assuming he could ever be taken off the machine and go home. I would not ask you to marry him under those conditions. He looked down at the empty glass in his hand. I may have to ask them to turn the machine off and let him die, he added sadly. What sort of life could he have after
after...
Gerda rose and embraced her husband, holding him tightly. Gudrun looked away, torn between embarrassment and guilt. She'd stripped away the lies they'd told themselves, the hopes they'd clung to, and now Volker Schulze was drinking and his wife was crying. It was her fault. But they would have found out sooner or later, she thought, as she rose herself. They would have guessed the truth after Conrad remained silent. She could feel her own eyes tearing up. If she'd allowed herself to cry for Conrad earlier, she pushed the thought aside. She'd avenge her boyfriend if it was the last thing she did.
I will speak to your father, Volker Schulze said stiffly. And it would not be proper for you to visit again.
Volker! Gerda snapped. I understand, Gudrun said. As Conrad's girlfriend, she could go to his house even when he wasn't present. As an unmarried girl, it wouldn't be proper for her to visit. Please tell Liana that I am sorry I won't be able to speak to her again. You can talk to her outside the house, Gerda said sharply. She made a visible effort to calm herself. If you want to sit here for a while, you can. I'd better go, Gudrun said. She had no idea what she'd started. What would Conrad's parents do now they knew their son was a brain-damaged cripple? Volker Schulze was a stubborn man, one experienced in the ways of the SS. What would he do?
And I'm sorry.
So are we, Gerda said. You would have made a good daughter-in-law. Perhaps, Gudrun thought. Or perhaps you would have found me a tiresome girl who wanted a career of her own. She pushed the thought aside as she strode out of the room and out onto the streets, silently grateful that Liana was nowhere in sight. Gudrun wasn't sure she could have faced Conrad's sister, not now. And to think Gerda wanted to try to marry Liana to Kurt. Was there a reason they wanted to marry their daughter off at such a young age? What age had Gerda been when she'd married Volker Schulze? Gudrun was so wrapped up in her thoughts that she was barely aware of her surroundings until she was standing in front of her door, fumbling for the key. Her mother opened the door before she could get the key into the lock, then pulled Gudrun into a hug. Gerda must have called her, Gudrun realized, as she allowed her mother to hold her tightly. Her father probably wouldn't be home from the station until the evening, unless he came home especially for her. It didn't seem likely, somehow.
I'm sorry, her mother said, as she helped Gudrun into the living room. I know you loved him.
Gudrun shuddered, feeling tears welling up in her eyes.
He deserved so much better, she said. I loved him. We were going to marry and...
I know,
her mother said, wrapping an arm around Gudrun's shoulders.
You and he would have been good together.
We would have been better than good, Gudrun thought, miserably. She'd bottled up her tears, knowing she dared not cry without a reason she could tell her mother, but now she let them flow freely. Conrad wasn't dead, yet his life was effectively over. We would have lived together, built a life together, and...
Hey, crybaby, Siegfried called, peering into the room. What's...
Get up to your room and wait until your father gets home, his mother snapped.
Siegfried recoiled in shock. Their mother rarely told off her youngest child.
He'll have more than a few words to give you.
She turned back to Gudrun as Siegfried fled up the stairs.
I do understand, my darling,
she whispered into Gudrun's ear, rocking her like a baby.
Cry all you like. Let it out. There's nothing else you can do.
But there is, Gudrun thought bitterly. The leaflets were just the beginning. We can make the state pay for what it's done. Chapter 21 Berlin, Germany 4 August 1985 My sister is playing a very dangerous game, Leutnant Kurt Wieland thought as he stepped into the barracks. And who knows what will happen when something goes badly wrong. It wasn't a pleasant thought. No one else seemed to have realized that Gudrun was responsible for the leaflets.
but Kurt knew all too well that Gudrun had means, motive, and opportunity. She might have been a girl, yet she'd been brave enough to sneak into a secure hospital just to visit her boyfriend. Kurt couldn't have asked for more from the soldiers under his command.
"Leutnant," Oberfeldwebel Helmut Loeb said, "the CO has called a briefing in 10 minutes.
"And I'm expected to attend," Kurt said.
Loeb was an NCO, old enough to be Kurt's father. He'd forgotten more about war than Kurt had ever known.
"I'll be there."
He placed his knapsack in the locker, then hurried down to the briefing room. The ordinary soldiers had an additional 2 days of leave, while their officers and NCOs received their orders from their superiors and planned how best to carry them out. Kurt had a nasty feeling that the Berlin Guard was going to be deployed away from Berlin for the first time in quite some time, perhaps as a complete unit. Individual companies had been rotated through Germany East, Germany Arabia, and Germany South to give their officers and men some valuable experience, but the Berlin Guard as a whole hadn't left Berlin for years. Their battle honors had been allowed to lapse. "But we weren't meant to face real trouble in South Africa," Kurt thought. He remembered feeling envious of the soldiers who'd been sent to South Africa. It might not be a proper war, but at least it was some action. Now, if the rumors are accurate, the war in South Africa may blaze on for years with no end in sight. He pushed the thought aside as he entered the briefing room. It was pleasantly informal while the soldiers were still on leave. The CO was standing in front of a podium, while his subordinates were pouring themselves mugs of black coffee and sitting down on hard metal chairs in front of him. A large map of South Africa hung from the wall, suggesting that Gudrun had been right and the Berlin Guard was going to the war. Kurt couldn't help a flicker of fear and dread as he poured himself coffee and sat down. He knew he was brave, but the thought of ending up like Conrad, his body a mangled wreck, was terrifying. He would sooner die. "And my family might not know what happened to me," he thought grimly. He wasn't quite sure how Gudrun had found out where Conrad was, but after the leaflets had started to appear, it was unlikely her source would dare tell her anything else. "They'd have a sudden end to my letters, and nothing." It was a bitter thought. He prided himself on being faithful. He'd always been faithful, right from the moment he'd first entered the Hitler Youth. He'd enjoyed himself, singing songs, marching in unison, and practicing with guns, even as some of the more sensitive souls had found the Hitler Youth a foretaste of hell. And yet, if someone as faithful as Conrad, and an SS officer no less, could simply be discarded, it could happen to him. How could he be loyal to the Third Reich when it was clear that the Third Reich was not loyal to its fighting men? Kurt had no illusions. People died on military service. Hell, he'd watched in horror as a boy died on the ropes back in the Hitler Youth. The teenagers had been told that the boy had effectively been an Untermensch, that he'd deserved to die through sheer incompetence. In hindsight, Kurt wondered if it had been wise to force the poor boy to try to climb slippery ropes when his skill at climbing ropes was minimal. But even if the masters had been right, it didn't justify hiding the dead and wounded and then lying about it. Didn't Conrad's family deserve some closure? "I'm sorry, Gudrun," he thought, as the CO tapped the podium for attention. "I wish I was there for you." That, too, was not a pleasant thought. Kurt would happily have beaten his younger brother to a pulp for daring to make fun of Gudrun's grief. But he had no idea how to comfort a stricken soul. Gudrun had known Conrad had been badly injured, yet she'd been able to cling to hope until Conrad's family had formally terminated the engagement. It wouldn't reflect badly on her, Kurt was sure, but it had still been shattering. And given what else she was doing, she really didn't need the stress.
"Our new deployment orders have finally arrived," the CO said, after the standard Heil Bormann. "The Berlin Guard, all 5,000 of us, is going to be deployed to South Africa in the next 3 months, where we will be reinforcing troops already on the ground. We will commence tactical exercises
as soon as the troops report back to barracks, focused around convoy protection, aggressive patrolling, and counter-terrorism operations. This is an opportunity for us to be blooded as a unit, rather than as a handful of individual companies.
And an opportunity to wind up crippled, Kurt thought sardonically. He wasn't fool enough to say that out loud. Who knows what will happen if one of us winds up dead or wounded? He listened, carefully, as the CO ran through the first set of assignments. Moving a military unit from Germany Prime to Germany South would be a logistical nightmare, even though the Kriegsmarine seemed confident it had the shipping to move thousands of troops and their equipment from Berlin to the ports in Africa. After that, it would be worse, he suspected, when he looked at the briefing notes. The news claimed that Germany South was safe, but they wouldn't have been ordered to prepare to defend their convoys if there wasn't a risk of being attacked. And afterwards, the population map made the problem far too clear. South Africa had 57 million people within its borders, a mere 5 million of whom were white. It looked very much as though the South Africans were either refusing to breed or fleeing the country, no matter what their government had to say about it. Even if one counted the relatively small Indian and Chinese populations as white, it was still clear that the white population was staggeringly outnumbered. The CO might insist that one good German was worth 10 black men, but Kurt had the uneasy feeling that the blacks could afford to trade 10 of their men for one German and still come out ahead. And if there were parts of Russia that were still dangerous, even 40 years after the conquest, who knew how long it would take to pacify South Africa?
This could take a while, Leutnant Bernhard Schrupp muttered.
Kurt winced inwardly, hoping desperately that the CO hadn't overheard Schrupp's rather sarcastic comment. Schrupp wasn't a bad person, not really, but he had a tendency to grumble and ask pointed questions. Indeed, Kurt had often wondered how Schrupp had managed to win promotion in the first place. As far as he knew, Schrupp didn't have any relatives in high places.
A number of officers who have served in South Africa will be arriving at the barracks tomorrow, the CO concluded. You will have a chance to learn from their experiences and prepare exercises for the troops. Dismissed.
Kurt saluted, then rose with the other officers. There were briefing papers to read, then officers to interrogate. He needed to be ready by the time the troops returned to their barracks and readied themselves for war. And yet, there was a gnawing feeling in his chest that all was not right, that going to South Africa might be the last thing he'd ever do. It just didn't seem right. We might not be able to win, he thought, taking a long look at the map. How do we crush a rebellion that has over 90% of the population on its side? Schrupp followed him back to the barracks, then into one of the small offices they were allowed to use for their paperwork.
I read the leaflets, he said, once the door was firmly closed. We might be going to our deaths.
That's always a risk, Kurt pointed out, trying hard to keep his face impassive.
One day, Schrupp would go too far and wind up hauled off by the SS for interrogation.
We're not sailors, you know.
My brother is a sailor on the Graf Zeppelin, Schrupp said. He says that life on the ocean waves can be just as dangerous as life in the here.
Kurt snorted. It was an article of faith among the soldiers, and the Waffen SS, he suspected, that the Kriegsmarine sailors did nothing more than sit in port, scrub their decks, and try to look good in their fancy uniforms. And it might even be true. The sea could be rough. He'd enjoyed sailing with the Hitler Youth, once he'd managed to recover from an unexpected bout of seasickness. But it wasn't as dangerous as being shot at by insurgents.
But that isn't the point, Schrupp added after a moment. What happens to us when we get wounded in South Africa?
Good question, Kurt said. Why don't you ask the CO?
Schrupp gave him a sardonic look.
Do you think he'd give me a straight answer?
He turned and headed out of the tiny office before Kurt could formulate a response. Kurt watched him go, trying to understand what Schrupp was doing. Grumbling was one thing,
but doing something, anything, that could be taken as trying to prepare the ground for a mutiny was quite another. Kurt could report him right away, and Shrupp's career would come to a screeching halt, even if he avoided anything worse than the punishment units in Germany East. It was Kurt's duty to report him, and yet, betraying Shrupp would ensure that no one ever trusted him again. Maybe I should just leave him to get on with it, Kurt thought. But the thought kept nagging at his mind. He'd be leading a platoon into combat in South Africa, with a number of men under his command, men he'd be responsible for. What would happen when one of them died while under his command? Would the dead man's family be informed, or would they just be left in limbo? He shuddered. Perhaps it would have been better if he hadn't accompanied Gudrun to the hospital. If he'd reported her to their father as soon as she asked for his help. But he hadn't, and now he had to deal with his own doubts about the Reich. "And we're leaving for South Africa in 3 months," he reminded himself. "By then, something may change." Volker Schulze knew, from hard experience, that life could be painful. He'd joined the SS as a young man, gone through a brutal training program that killed a handful of new recruits every year, and served as a frontline Waffen SS soldier for 15 years before retiring and going to work in a factory. He had no illusions about the world. It was a brutal place, and the Third Reich needed brutal men to dominate it. Loyalty had been hammered into him from birth. And yet, he was angry. He'd known that Conrad could end up dead or wounded. He had accepted that the moment Conrad insisted on following in his father's footsteps and applying to join the Waffen SS. Conrad might die in training, let alone in the field. Volker had accepted that, he told himself, and yet he'd believed that his loyalty would always be returned. The SS would have told his parents if he had died, he was sure, and they should have told him when his son was brutally wounded, permanently crippled. But they hadn't. They'd lied to him. And even his contacts within the bureaucracy hadn't been able to locate his son. The thought had nagged at his mind ever since he'd discovered the truth. He'd given the best years of his life to the Reich. His son, it seemed, had lost his life for the Reich. And yet, the Reich hadn't even tried to honor his death. Conrad should have been allowed to die with dignity, his family by his side, his body laid to rest in the ground. Instead, he was trapped on life support, eternally suspended on the brink of death, his hopes and dreams smashed along with his body. And they'd lied to him. He mulled the feeling over as he made his way slowly into the giant factory complex, nodding to a handful of men he recognized along the way. The giant complex produced vehicles, ranging from the handful of publicly available cars to lorries and small armored patrol vehicles for the military. He'd been proud to work in the factory once upon a time. It had seemed a chance to make use of his experience, even though he was no longer a Waffen SS stormtrooper. Now it had all turned to ashes in his mouth.
"Volker," the secretary said as he entered the office, "what can I do for you?"
Volker sighed inwardly. The secretary had never served. He'd gone straight into the corporate sphere as soon as he'd graduated from school, instead of volunteering for active service. Volker had always disliked him. But now he wished Conrad had chosen to do something, anything else, to prove he was a man. At least he'd still be alive.
"I wanted to arrange a meeting of everyone who has a relative in the military," he said.
The secretary would have no trouble putting together a list just by consulting the files.
"Have them assemble in the cafeteria after the next shift."
The secretary frowned.
"I could only ask the workers on the current shift," he said after a moment, "unless you wanted to put it off for a couple of days so that everyone could be informed."
"Just inform as many as you can," Volker said. "I intend to find a way to honor our serving men."
He turned and strode out, confident his orders would be obeyed. The secretary wouldn't defy him on such a minor matter, even though he'd probably report the meeting.